that we're not just changing the wallpaper, we are taking the whole foundation out and rebuilding.
There are a series of mines that are being deliberately planted to make change difficult.
That I am not 100% confident that we won't get to 2029 and a confected national emergency may be used to defer an election. I'm not saying that will happen, but I can't believe those words are passing my lips.
What can we learn from your experiences being in office for the last year? Something that can take us through to the general election?
I think what we've seen across this country for decades is that elected officials are not actually in charge. There's a group of officers or civil servants, as you know, I call them the blob, that are actually in charge of this country, that make the decisions. When councillors or elected officials, with their pay so low and the quality of a councillor so low, the big decisions that have to be made are normally left to the officers, the non-elected bureaucrats that you cannot hold to account. So when I first become the leader of the council, I knew that that was the case. And on councils, you normally say it's either an officer-led organisation or a member-led, a councillor-led. And one of the main, the first decisions that obviously we took to change was the flag policy, that there shouldn't be every single flag on the flagpole. It should be the Union flag, the St. George's and the county flag. That represents everybody. And when communicating my decision as leader of the council to the chief executive officer of the council, oh no, you can't do that. I said, well, I'm the lead. I've got the mandate to serve. I've got the mandate to lead this council. Why can't I make this decision? Oh, it's been delegated to me by the previous leader. So I go, okay, I'll take it back. I'll take that power back. Oh, you can't do that. And that's the thing. If the councillor, the elected leader, has said that he wants to do this, you know, change the flag policy, then the officers are there to serve the councillors. So they will make it work. They will change policy to do what the elected officials tell them to do. And it took about a month just to create this policy, because she was not having it. Now, obviously, when you go into an organisation, you do clash heads with these type of people originally. But you have to put a shot across the bow. You have to show them that we are in charge. And now they are listening. They are doing as we instruct them to do. And that is one of the biggest things that we need to put forward when we get into government. Because if we, you know, on the councils know that there's this blob, there's this people in the offices that we never see that actually run the show, what is it like in Whitehall? We have to reduce the size of the blob, which then gives... Remember when you all voted to leave the European Union? It was because your MPs were saying, oh no, it's not me, it's Europe. They had someone else to blame. So you voted to leave the European Union to hold your politicians to account. And that's what this does. Make sure that local councillors, MPs, are actually at the helm of decision-making, not non-elected bureaucrats. So then your MPs, and then when we get into government, they will be able to make all the decisions. Then you can hold them to account. Then the decision-making is made by the voters, not by some non-elected bureaucrat paid £200,000 a year. And that's what we have to change straight away, is to ensure that the Prime Minister, Nigel Farage, is solely in charge. You have to do that constitutional reform. I know it's a boring subject, but what's more important, actually leading and actually being in charge, or just a few policies? You have to start from the very, very beginning. Remember, this country is rotten to the core, and we have to start from the start. You know, we're not just changing the wallpaper. We are taking the whole foundation out and rebuilding. It is a hard task, but that is what we have to do.
So Dan, on that note, really George is talking about wholesale cultural change within local government and national government, so that unelected bureaucrats, as he calls them, are or have the authority given to them to do their job by the elected officials, and they are accountable to those elected officials. So at a national level, what do you see that, how do you see that happening in government?
Well, I think the you know, the key thing, if you look at what the Tories did when they came under let's say Boris Johnson with Dominic Cummings there, talking tough, a lot of sabre rattling, how they're going to transform, they were going to put the civil service in the place and they were going to do what they're told, but there was no plan. There was no plan, and all the civil servants were sat there with their arms crossed saying, well, we'll see about that. And exactly that, they then took over, they dictated what happened next through COVID and after that. So I think the lesson for us is we must go in with a plan. And I've worked in these kind of industries where you have to, you know, it's a transformation, it's called, where you go in where basically an essential service has to continue while you change the way that it works. So you've got to keep the patient alive while you do open heart surgery, but at the end of it, you want something that's improved and still alive. And I think that's what we need to have with the civil services. We need to go in with a plan that's worked out, that will work, to, you know, to get rid of people who have got too much power or who are going to work against us, and I think those people will be known for those who are on the inside, and maybe change the way some of the structures happen, change the terms and conditions that the people work to, how they're incentivized. But I think what people do need to accept is that is a 5-year minimum journey, and perhaps it's only at the end of the second parliament, you know, 10 years, where you really see a transformed civil service. And I think that's what we've got to try and sell to people is you might get a few quick wins, but you're not going to get real change in less than a handful of years.
Now, David and Mark, I see you as critical friends to reform. And you have come along, you came along to the conference last year, you're coming along tonight, and you have a passion and a mission to unite the centre-right, as you call it. But I think your knowledge, your understanding of history is absolutely vital for us to understand, to be able to put those priorities right. So David, coming to you, what would you say should be Reform's top three priorities in the first 100 days of a Reform UK government?
I think what one's got to do immediately is to begin that process of demolition. The problem is the structures that have been described on both sides are bound together by law, and they are mutually supporting. What we can't do is just have a checklist. You can't just decide we will undo the ECHR this week and we'll tackle this next week and whatever. I think that there will have to be a kind of all-out assault on the sense, on the central principles that bind the Blairite state together. Now, this is something that is being worked on, that serious lawyers are discussing, are considering. One of the essential things, and you mentioned the actual terms, one of the things that's happened with the various acts which govern the status of civil servants now have a duty to maintain the rule of law. That gives them the ability to say to a minister, oh, minister, couldn't possibly do that. It's illegal. And one is going to have to confront this entire mindset. But it will require a degree of confidence. It will require something of Donald Trump's arrogance and energy and determination to take flak, because there will be a vast amount of flak. I mean, you've described it perfectly. There is an arrogance. There is, of course, we forget, all of this is also bound together by a trade union movement. I don't know whether you've noticed the new trade union, the new workers' rights bill that's going through. It provides for unlimited compensation. It is being widely discussed on the right that this is a deliberate tactic to make it impossible to cut back on the civil service. We've already seen, there's a very interesting test case, which is the Labour, what is so striking, Labour know them, there's intelligent members of the Labour Party, know this is just as much a problem as we do. The journal that is actually keeping the best tabs on this, believe it or not, is the New Statesman. the one that is actually following most closely the kind of arguments we're all having. So we have got to have this. This is an almost an ability to do it. It sounds mad, but we have finally to be prepared to do all the key things at once, and that is going to involve. One thing did slip my mind. We've got a clear case of how Labour have been trying actually to abolish the NHS quango. They have found it impossible because the costs of abolishing it are going to be so gigantic in terms of the salaries. And there are a series of mines that are being deliberately planted to make change difficult. All I can say is prepare. If you look at that extraordinary moment, I mentioned it in my talk, when Trump sits down at the desk with Steve Miller behind him, people worked on some of those executive orders. A senior lawyer worked on them for 12 months on the one document.
One
document to get it right, to make it watertight.
So with that in mind, Mark, the economy. I'd like you to comment on the economy in particular.
I have many Ronald Reagan quotes that I like, but one of my favourite ones, which is extremely profound, is that he said, there are no easy solutions, but there are simple solutions. But actually what you need to do might be difficult to do, but it's straightforward. On the economy, you are going to have to find a way to reduce government expenditure by perhaps as much as £150 billion immediately. That is the budget deficit. And that's just to balance the bloody books, right? There's no room for tax cuts until you've gone further than that. So the essay question, Wendy, I think that Reform, or anyone who aspires to form the next government, because I'm not making an ideological point here. This isn't a point of ideology. This is a point of math, right? That is the scale of the budget deficit. You need to work out how you can find those savings fast in a way which is something approaching fair, right? You might want to entertain a complete public sector pay freeze for 5 years, for example. You know, there needs to be things on these sort of scales, right? And you've got to find that quickly. That if you start... If you do really what this government's doing, of going around looking about whether you can find a few quid down the back of the sofa, you are absolutely lost. It's a disaster. All of this nonsense about the inherited £20 billion black hole, even if that was true, that's a rounding error in our public finances. This is like worrying that you've left 10 quid down the back of the sofa when your house is on fire. Right, don't worry so much about the 10 quid down the back of the sofa, worry about putting the fire out. And I just got one thought about, you know, I'm not sure I can list the sort of three things I would do first, but this is how you should approach the problem, I think. And from what I can gather, and I've spoken to him a couple of times about it, Danny Kruger is approaching this in a sensible and methodical fashion. You're going to need two things. Danny has got to produce for you a playbook, right? And if Nigel is the Prime Minister, he opens it up, he turns to page one, and it says, right, it is 11 o'clock on Friday morning, you have just got back from Buckingham Palace. The first thing you're going to do is to issue this memo to every single civil servant in Britain. The second thing you're going to do after lunch is this. The third thing you're going to do tomorrow is that. Now, obviously, it won't actually turn out to be word perfect by the time you're on to day 100, day 1,000, but that playbook needs to be created. And I'm not suggesting that's the first time Nigel Farage should have sight of it, by the way, but nevertheless, this is the manual. This is the playbook. And the second thing, which again I think Danny is attuned to, but is crucial, you are going to need a very large number of extremely talented people, right? To form a government, you're going to need at least 350 MPs if you're interested in having a workable majority. You may well have to put a number of about that size straight into the House of Lords, if there's going to be Lords blockage. I would recommend that you change the civil service such that permanent secretaries, director generals and directors are political appointees, right? That the Secretary of State says, I want these people, rather than a permanent standing bureaucracy. You are probably looking at needing 3,000 really good people to run the government. Whether that's Danny's job, or, you know, well, Nigel would obviously have to be happy with them, or Zia's job, I'm not sure, but you have got to start building that list of names and assigning them to jobs now. That was another great success of Trump 2.0. They knew the name of everyone they were going to put in. This is the bloke we're going to get into the water regulation sector. This is the bloke we're going to get into the tech regulation sector. Hundreds of them. So that's the way to approach it. Write that playbook and build the list of your players. But unlike football, you know, 11 won't be enough. And bear in mind, you've only got six MPs at the moment. You're going to need several thousand people. Start recruiting them now and start allocating them to tasks now.
Yes, I think that, again, this is really implicit in pretty much everything that's been said so far. There's been the enormous failure on the right to grasp patronage. The state potentially has huge power of appointment in all of these bodies we've been talking about, in the church, in the universities. It was all deliberately devolved to committees, because committees are filled with experts, and we know which side experts are on. There's a reform government is going to need to seize patronage with confidence. But that involves a knowledge of universities, it involves a knowledge of the Church of England, of body after body, many of which are very alien to most of the people who are involved. But that has to be seized. And until Gordon Brown threw it away, the key chair, I mean, just, we all know the universities have got badly out of control. And one of the reasons for that is Gordon Brown deliberately removed the right of the Crown, that's to say the Prime Minister, to appoint senior chairs, the Regius chairs. That's got to be repossessed. The honour system has got to be repossessed. It's all decided by committees. And that we've, in other words, the fundamental point that I want to make: reform will only succeed if it has a confidence in the political process. Now that means a confidence in you, and it means also a confidence that these ideas will have been communicated. There's no point in MPs suddenly finding themselves trying to defend policies that have not been explained. What you could see in the last election is the catastrophe of a government that lies its way to office. And we've got used to lies. We've become addicted to lies. I want to suggest, and again, Robert Jenrick used that phrase, it's time for the truth. Can we all be honest with ourselves? There's going to be need for, if we are to engage on this process that we all know is fundamentally necessary, there is going to have to be a ruthless honesty. If not, we are lost.
I echo that. I mean, I think if Labour had been honest with the electorate, I would not have liked any of their proposals at the last election. But I don't think they would have got themselves into the mess that they've got themselves into now. Do not believe that you can do this by stealth. You can't win an election on a soundbite or some weasel words that make it look like you're not going to do X when you really know you are. You're going to have to be honest with the British people, and you're going to have to say some things to them which are not going to be easy to say, some home truths. And you are going to have to win an election on that platform. Because if you do it the Starmer way, you will have no mandate, and the whole thing will unravel immediately. Let's see how many Ronnie Reagan quotes I can shoehorn into this panel discussion. I mean, he was bang on right on the government's, any government's typical approach to the economy, is if it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidise it. That pretty much sums up how we approach things. You're going to have to get off that. And if we are serious about these savings, right, I know this is on the economic end of the equation, not so much the constitutional end of the equation, you won't be able to make the savings that are needed by just eliminating waste, right? I'm all in favour of money not being wasted on rainbow lanyards and all of that sort of stuff, but this is a rounding error within the budget deficit. And if you are serious about getting government spending under control, and if you're not, this country will go bust, you are going to have to look at the three biggest budgets, which are welfare spending, health spending, and education spending. You're getting on to that being about two-thirds of government expenditure. Sure, close down the Arts Council, be my guest. Please do close down the Arts Council. But don't imagine that that is anything other than a rounding error. And on welfare, I haven't got a proposal for you again, though, Wendy, it's just a way of looking at it. If you were to look at our welfare state in Britain, and by the welfare state, I just mean what economists call transfer payments, cash handouts, right? Moving money from one cohort taxpayers to another. So that includes the state pension, it includes child benefit, it includes housing benefit, cash, checks, payments into your account given by the state. The total cost of all the money that we are moving around to attempt to cure poverty comes in at about £13,000 per household per year. Given that an overwhelming majority of households, you would assume, don't need any state support, 70, 80, maybe 90% shouldn't need state support, how is it that £13,000 per household per year is not enough to crack poverty? I mean, if you do the simple math, if you just targeted that on the bottom 10% of households, you could give them £130,000 a year each. Again, Ronnie Reagan, somewhere there must be some overhead, he said about this. But if you're looking at the big savings, you've got to find a way to do this. It is controversial. It needs to be done delicately. It needs to be done with a degree of compassion and kindness, that people are confident that those who need it will get the support. But that's where the big bucks are. Investigate that, dig into it, and work out where you can make those big savings.
Yes, yeah, so I'd look at this from a local government perspective. So everybody here wants their potholes filled. Everybody wants their resources in their local areas higher. But what we're seeing is a complete and utter lack of support from national government to local government. For example, like you said about the three largest departments in the councils, SEND, adult social care, and education. They're the three biggest in councils. We spend £50 million a year taking 10,000 children to and from school every day. 50 million, right? And I stood up and I said, this is down to parental responsibility, not the taxpayer. And, you know, at this current time, the councils are going through their budget setting process. So this is probably one of the best times to talk about these things. And what we're finding is that everybody, you know, in this room, Conservatives and Reform, they want lower tax and lower spending. So the state needs to shrink, i.e. local government needs to shrink. We are a council or a business that has a staff of 6,000 and it is not running correctly. So we need to look at efficiencies there with the staff, with the amount of people we have as a council. We need to change the way it runs. You know, there are difficult decisions. There are councillors that are going to get flack and MPs that are going to get flack. But you have to do it with compassion, like you said. You know, I've got a sister with SEND needs. So when I do stand up and talk about how we do need to reform those SEND needs and how we do, you know, homeschool transport, right? 10,000 children, 7,500 of those children are normal like me. They haven't got any needs or disabilities. 2,500 do. So I've said that I would not cut homeschool transport for children that are disabled or are in low deprivation areas. High deprivation areas. But what I will do is change the way it's done. So instead of two taxis turning up to the same street, two houses, taking the same kids to the same school, no, let's stick them in the same taxi. That costs thousands of pounds. We will save that. That's how you have to do it. And then, if local government can save money, then it doesn't have to come from local taxpayers. So it doesn't come out of your pocket. I'm with the officers at the moment going through the budget. The easy option is to tax you more. The harder option is to go through the books and change the way it's done. Because why? Because that you would then be attacking their record for the last 20, 30 years. They've allowed it to get into that mess that it's in. And we've come in and gone, this is not right. And we are facing, you know, that backlash from the state. They're saying, no, this is great. Listen to us. You know, pat you on your head and send you on your way. But when we kind of rebel and fight back, what we're finding is there's millions and millions of pounds to save. But one thing councils are terrible at is increasing commercial revenue, bringing money into the council that's not from the taxpayer, but from creating the council into a small business on things. Like in Warwickshire, we've got Warwick Castle, we've got Kingsbury Water Park, Kenilworth Castle. Let's bring in the revenue. We can do that, but there's no commercial mind. So that's where you do have to bring in new, fresh people with business mind. That's why reform councillors, I would never call them politicians. We're real people with backgrounds. You know, we're all, you know, not normal, but we think differently. That's why things get changed. That's why they're against us. That's why they keep attacking us every single time, the state, the media, you, the politicians. It's because we are going to find where those bodies are buried. And it is bad. It's rotten, like I said before. And you know, you think the councils are bad. Wait until you get into Whitehall and we can get our grubby little fingers on what's going on in there. Because we can seriously make some change in Whitehall.
Danny Kruger has a portfolio of preparing for government. And he's not someone who courts the limelight. He is someone who's a thinker, written books like David, not the same sort of books, all of it. But he's someone who thinks, he likes to do the detailed work, and he's pulling together people and a team to do that detailed work for the playbook, as Mark suggests. So there is a plan. And you've got Zia, who's also got a separate but parallel activity, looking at policy. He's got a team, he's recruiting people. Currently, they're working on the Welsh and Scottish manifestos, policies for those elections in May. There's also work going on one for, obviously, for the national, for Westminster. So it's no small task, but I think you should just trust that there is a plan and they are working on it.
I think we, and I say this with profound self-doubt, I think there are fundamental problems with the monarchy at the moment in terms of both the institution and the occupant of the throne. I also think, and I am now going to be even more controversial, we've got to stop idealising the late Queen. The late Queen, with her ludicrous fascination with the Commonwealth, is the one who opens the gates to, on the one hand, multiculturalism, and on the other hand, to a lack of focus on Britain itself. The great advantage of the continental monarchies is that they are undoubtedly the above political representative of each nation. You see it particularly clearly with the Dutch monarchy, going back to Mark's fascination with football. The football strip of the Dutch team is not the colours of the Netherlands, which are red, white and blue. It's orange, which is the colour of the House of Orange, which is the royal house. Our monarchy is far too diffuse. It's the fact that it's head of state of other countries is problematic. The fact that we have a king who wants to be head of all faiths is profoundly problematic. The fact, I'm afraid, that we have a monarchy which is terrifyingly closely aligned with the blob is the most alarming thing of the lot. And we're going to have to confront the fact that that monarchy is going to have to be told what it has to do. The first thing, again, we haven't really talked about the detail of those first days. The appointment of peers needs to go through the Crown. the exercise of patronage powers goes through the Crown. There's going to have to be a very early, if reform continues to be in its present position, channels are going to have to be opened to the private secretary. There is going to have to be proper discussion. And these aren't going to be really difficult. It's happened before. Monarchs have been told, this is the position. If not, I could see, with the obstinacy of the present monarch and even more his son, public opposition. But we need to be thinking about these questions. We can't just brush them under the carpet.
Yep.
And again, I think all of us, with the profound problems with aggressive Islamism, the fact that in, of all places, Great Hall, St George's Hall at Windsor, you had a celebration of whatever it is, the concluding feast. I found that deeply, deeply disturbing. And we had another one, in Westminster Hall. I wonder why, in fact, so I'm thinking aloud, but I'm also daring to say things that I haven't said publicly before. I think we may even need to consider, do we want all religions to be established? Because the one thing we used to have was what's called, again, you'll forgive complicated words, but they're important. The reason that we had toleration in this country, we never let the church run the state. From dear old Henry VIII onwards, the church was under the state. This is a really good thing. You look what happens when you give the Church of England the freedom to elect its own archbishops and bishops. You get the fearful woman who's just been appointed Archbishop of Canterbury. It is a very bad idea. And we need to do what the UEA does, which is to have the imams under the control of the state. Otherwise, we're lost. And I would also say that probably applies to Judaism as well. I mean, otherwise we're going straight down a deadly route of sectarianism, which we haven't mentioned. The Crown, properly deployed, really rethinking what it's about, has to be a fundamental part of the reconstruction of this nation. We are a monarchical nation. The monarchy and the church are the only continuous threads in English history that go right back to the foundation of England in about 500 or 600. Parliament comes in later, it's about 800 years old. And these things are central, and they've got to be part. They need to be part of our rethinking the country.
This is absolutely shocking, isn't it? I mean, this is completely inexcusable. And I am annoyed at myself for taking the government at its word last year. I kind of thought, oh, well, okay, if they're going to do a few rejigs and restructures, I wouldn't want them to waste money on elections for an authority that may be abolished. Totally unacceptable for that to happen in a second year. Absolutely, totally unacceptable. The Electoral Commission, now I don't want to big them up because those are exactly this bunch of quangos and experts that I want to get rid of, but has said that they cannot credit that this is a substantial enough reason to postpone or cancel an election. You know, a pandemic, foot and mouth disease, a war, okay, but the fact that we might shuffle around some filing cabinets between a district council and a county council is not good enough grounds to cancel elections 2 years in a row. So having reached that conclusion, I am quite nervous, actually. I don't want to ascribe ill intention to people unless I'm certain of it, so it's only a nervousness, it's not an accusation. But I don't know how many of you watched Dominic Cummings' interview with Maddie Grant and Michael Gove of The Spectator. If not, look it up online, it's fascinating. Cummings makes it plain that the blob, the vested interest, the establishment, will throw everything at trying to stop a reform government. Everything. They will try to leak Nigel Farage's medical records. They will tap his phone. This is Cummings. I'm just quoting Cummings. Everything will be thrown at this. And therefore, I have to say, I'm very sorry to say this, that I am not 100% confident that we won't get to 2029 and a confected national emergency may be used to defer an election. I'm not saying that will happen, but I can't believe those words are passing my lips in this country. That should have a nil percentage chance, and I'm afraid it's measurably higher than that. So, well done, Reform, for taking the government to court. I can't comment on the strength of its legal case. I rather hope that there is some strength to it rather than it just being to draw attention to it. Let's hope that battle is won, because when you start postponing elections, you know what the next step is on that road, don't you? And therefore, let's fight this battle here and now, right now, as loud and hard as we possibly can, because, my God, this is a very dangerous path.
Just to add in on that, is that in Warwickshire, we're going through that local government reorganisation. And we've got borough elections that are going ahead this year. And the reason as to why they think they can postpone these elections is because the district councils and the borough councils and the county won't exist in 2028. So my question is then, if the budget for the elections and the cost has already been accounted for, if the training sessions are already going ahead for council staff, why are we to cancel them? The minister, now look, I don't know if she's, you know, honest or not, but she did say that if those boxes are already ticked, the elections should go ahead. But when I received the letter from the minister saying that they're inviting council leaders to council elections, I did the research. There were 63 councils on that list. 46% of those councils are Labour-ran councils. So that's the question I have to the Labour government. Why are the majority of the councils that are up for that are in that list of 63, why are they Labour-ran councils, and what are you trying to stop? Because in Eton and Bedworth, where we were going to have elections, and in Rugby, it's a mathematical certainty that Reform would win those elections and run those councils. There's the leader of Rugby Borough Council, who's up for re-election this year, voted to cancel those elections, and he was the third top seat for us to win. You know what's going on. And it was what Zia said on Twitter, which was X, which is what was perfect. When animals are dying, they're the most ferocious they ever can be. And that is the state against Reform. So we have to bat together on this. You know, that's why we started petitions. We did town centre rallies. Hundreds of people. And look, most people don't know what goes on in councils, let's be honest. But they knew this was wrong. They knew this overstepped the mark. And that's, I think, the great awakening of all people is that, you know, when you knock on door and you had like a young mother, she said, oh, I don't know much about politics. But when you started to talk about issues, she was very wise about what was going on. So everybody does know about politics. Everybody is smart in their own way. And when you cross that line, that's when they get involved. And I think cancelling elections and postponing them is going across that line, and more people will get involved in politics because they'll see, what's the point of paying my council tax if I don't get to vote? So we have to make sure these go ahead. And look, that you've got councillors that are only elected for 2 years that get to serve another 2 years. And I've said to the leader, I wrote letters to the leader of the boroughs that are being postponed. I said, as of May 7th, if the elections don't go ahead, you are illegitimate, you are a squatter, and I will not be working with you as the county council leader. So you can fend on your own under this Labour manifesto. Is they made no promises, which means that they can't be held to account when they do many different things that we didn't think they'd do, which is things like this. But the way to stop that, we can't at this moment in time, because unfortunately this government has a massive majority that cannot be stopped. So we will have to wait.
Well, George, you do have one tool, I think, in your armoury that Richard Tice has been quite good at deploying, actually. And the precedent for this, I'll go back all the way to the Blair-Brown government, when the Labour Party was committed to bring in ID cards. Mm. This is a perennial, isn't it? It comes around every 20 years or so. And the Conservative front bench, and particularly it's David Davis who deserves the credit for this, made it absolutely plain that if the Conservatives won the 2010 election, we will not honour the contract. So if you are a software company getting involved in this sort of stuff, be aware that your contracts will not be honoured. And that has a huge chilling effect. It is absolutely outrageous, this discussion of the Farage clause in any new arrangement with the EU. The clue's in the name. It is designed to make it impossible for a future elected prime minister to carry out the will of the people. I think Reform's position would be they would not pay any fine.
That I think the key simply is preparation. Yeah. Preparation in terms of policy, preparation in terms of personnel, preparation in terms of publicity. P. And that's the only way. And it demands a new way of doing politics. It demands a confidence, a direct address to the people. It demands the kind of performance we've just seen here on stage now being replicated over the country. And with each one of your councillors, each one of the people who is elected to office, able to do that and trained up to do it, which is why these kind of events are so important. Because there's been what tends to happen now is people are elected to office and that's the last you see of them. What strikes me about our modern politics is just how little public involvement there actually is. This is why these are so wonderful. This used to be how politics was done, by the popular meeting. Our great prime ministers of the 19th century, Mark has heard this story until he's sick of it, and you may have been relatively impressed at what we were able to do in our just under hour on stage. Disraeli and Gladstone give two-hour speeches with no amplification in front of thousands of people, in Disraeli's case, powered by two bottles of brandy. But Mark is... I demanded the red wine. I said this was the driest event we'd ever done. But we've got to start to restore this normalcy of political involvement. That's what's got lost. That's what's gone wrong with big bureaucracy. Yeah. Once upon a time, before the disaster of the NHS, every hospital had a local hospital board. It was a charitable thing. People were involved in it. Each school was. Local government has got less and less local. Mm. You're simply a front now. You're simply a front. Isn't that true? You control tiny amounts of your expenditure. You've said that yourself. The thing that used to make us, if you look at the greatest political analysis, even greater than David Starkey, people like Edmund Burke, they talk about the little platoons. They talk about the business of self-government, of self-help. It's why jury service is so important. Mm. It's a training in the business of civilized debate. It's a practice in being a citizen. It's an involvement in public affairs. And we've lost so much of this. We've lost the friendly societies because people don't go to church very much anymore. Again, I look at my father's diaries in a period of 4 years in the 1930s when he was unemployed and desperately poor by anybody's standards, but the life is one of constant involvement and activity because of these multitudes of little organizations, and that's what made us free. Being free is just not voting once every 5 years. It really isn't. It's again how the Americans do it much better, where local government genuinely is local. What the government's doing now is exactly the opposite of what it should be doing. And I'm afraid the pass was sold by the Conservatives in 1972 with the 1972 local government reform, which abolishes the counties and the traditional boroughs and it's been downhill ever since then.
Yeah.
But it's this that's needed, and yeah. you're beginning to do it right. And the thing that strikes Mark and I when we go around is the liveliness of reform meetings. This sense of involvement, the combination of seriousness and fun and good fellowship and humour. And these are the traditional English-British virtues. And if we reconstruct... Thank you.